This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. Later this hour, we're going to learn about a project at Moat Marine Laboratory that's growing a salt-tolerant vegetable called sea purslane in an aquaponic system that's also raising redfish. But first, Southwest Florida-based maritime novelist Robert Macomber is out with his 14th novel in his award-winning Honor series. Macomber is known for his deeply researched naval thrillers. The latest, called Honoring the Enemy, is the second of a three-part miniseries within the Honor series about the Spanish-American War in Cuba and Puerto Rico. This one centers on a series of battles in 1898 in Cuba that were pivotal to America's rise as a global power. Macomber travels widely to research the places and cultures and people that populate his books, including sometimes with his fans, some of whom refer to themselves as Wakeians after the protagonist in his books. He actually just returned from such a trip to Cuba a few weeks ago. Robert Macomber, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
And as always, we invite you to join our conversation, especially if you're a fan of Mr. Macomber's books or just a history buff who wants to pick his brain. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So let's start with this trip to Cuba. You were just there a week and a half ago, right?
Yeah, I just got back. A week-long historical expedition. And we went from the invasion beach of 1898 all the way through the jungle battles. I took them to the trails where Theodore Roosevelt was first shot at. And those kind of events change your life forever, you know.
And this was – you were saying before, this is sort of a preview for the book for them,
and
right?
So they got to see all the places that are in the book a week before the book comes out. And then I took them into the hills where the hill battles were, and then we immersed them into the culture of eastern Cuba, which is different from the Havana area, which is far more cosmopolitan.
Gotcha.
So this is a more rural, more laid-back, different kind of culture. There's some subtle differences.
How many people were with you? How long were
you
there?
The total group was about 14 people.
Gotcha. Are these people who you have gotten to know now because they come on these trips, or
are they new faces,
or a blend of both?
It was a blend of both. Actually, most of them have been to Cuba with me before. And they want to come back, which made me feel good.
How much of the time there is spent, focusing on the places and the themes from the novel, and how much is just spent on, you know, being in Cuba in an interesting place with fun people?
Well, we do during the day, particularly in the mornings and early afternoons, we go and pay attention to the history. And I explain the history. Then we actually walk where history was made, where everything changed for this country and for Cuba and Spain and the world. And then later on in the day and in the evenings, we do the culture, the cuisines, the music, the gardens, the flora, the fauna. And all along in every day, every evening, they get to meet the average Cuban people. They're off the beaten path. We stay in private homes, we use private transportation, we eat in private restaurants, and they get to meet the struggling, incredibly struggling entrepreneurs of Cuba.
We'll get to some of the details of the history that you were there explaining, but how much do the people who you were interacting with, the Cuban people, how much do they know about that history? Is it something that's present for them, or is it something that maybe they don't really know?
You know, that's a very good question. They do know a lot about that history, particularly in eastern Cuba, on what happened there in 1898. It's part of their independence war. They call it the Spanish-Cuban-American War, which is the proper term for it. We got in on it late after they'd already been fighting for a long time.
We call it the Spanish-American War.
Right.
Right.
And they know aspects of it that most Americans don't.
Interesting.
When you read my books, you will. And they don't know certain other aspects from the American point of view of what happened. So I've been able to I work with a lot of Cuban historians, and I've been able to help them on some of the American information and the American views of what happened there. In fact, the first two people to get a book, this new book, the first two public people were two Cuban historians who would never have a chance to get the book otherwise, and we did a presentation to them in eastern Cuba.
So That's pretty cool. Yeah. So Theodore Roosevelt first got shot at. Mm-hmm. What's the backstory there? What was he doing there? How old was he at the time? He must have been a younger man at the time.
Yeah, he was only about 39. He had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and when the war came, the Navy was in pretty good shape as far as planning and mobilizing for this war.
This was late 1800s.
This is 1898, Spanish-American War, and the Army was in terrible shape, completely unprepared. We lost thousands of men because of their unpreparedness. It was amazingly inept.
Hmm.
Well, he left the Navy leadership and volunteered to serve in combat with the Army.
Hmm.
So he led as the assistant commander under a guy named Leonard Wood, who was a regular Army officer. He led a volunteer regiment of cavalry who go down through history by the nickname of the Rough Riders.
Heard of them.
When they got to Cuba, by the way, they weren't allowed to bring their horses, so they fought on foot.
They were the Rough Walkers.
Yeah, exactly. It was, and you know, I've been in exactly where every place they were at in the same time of year, in June, July, in the tropics. These guys came to Cuba with wool uniforms on.
Right. And they were miserable and moist.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they weren't ready. Roosevelt learned a lot very quickly. He was a very, very intelligent guy. Easily one of the top three intellectual presidents we've ever had.
Hmm.
He wrote 42 books and not with ghostwriters.
Right.
He actually wrote the books.
Wow.
And so he was one of these people that learns quickly, and he learned combat quickly and the art of leadership in combat quickly.
Hmm. And so what was he doing there? Like what was the
– He was an assistant regimental commander, and then when his commander got promoted up to general, he took over command of the regiment.
So step back and tell us what were the broader battle – what was – you know, paint the logistical picture of what was going on in terms of what was at stake, who was fighting who.
Well, the Cubans had been struggling for 30 years for independence. During that time, they had fought three large-scale hot wars. The last war was in the 1890s, and they had already been fighting for 3 years by the time we got involved. We came in as their allies, and we invaded Cuba at Santiago. And the idea was to capture Santiago and the Spanish fleet that was anchored in the bay there. We came extremely close to losing several of the battles there and losing the war on land.
Hmm.
The war at sea was stunningly victorious on the part of the Americans.
Was that a surprise?
No. The Americans knew they were in better condition, their ships and their training, their gunnery, than the Spanish. But they were still very concerned that perhaps something would go wrong or the Spanish would escape. And the big fear was that the Spanish would raid our Gulf and Eastern ports, which were basically defenseless. They had some antiquated forts. So if the Spanish fleet had raided the major ports of the East Coast of the United States, it could have caused complete pandemonium.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the fear about the Spanish fleet was.
Gotcha. And so this was sort of a proactive step to try
exactly
to keep that out of the way.
Yeah.
What explains the discrepancy between how strong our Navy was and how weak our Army was at that time?
Personalities at the top.
Hmm.
The personalities at the top were not – they weren't thinking proactively about getting ready for any kind of war with anybody. And it was a peacetime Army of only 27,000.
Hmm.
They expanded with volunteers from 27,000 to 274,000 inside of 4.5 months.
Oh, wow.
Does anybody think that went smoothly?
Yeah, I was going to say that seems like there's probably some undertrained people.
And Florida was the staging area for all this. So when they get down to Cuba, they find they only have 5 ambulances for 17,000 soldiers and they're going in combat.
Wow.
They couldn't find their equipment. They went ashore with only 3 days of food. It was a litany of disasters that should have been prevented.
Hmm. And yet they still pulled it off.
The average American soldier is what pulled it off.
Hmm. Peter Wake, Mm-hmm. Is he entirely fictional?
Yes.
From whole cloth all the way through.
He is.
Is he based on anybody? Is there some of you in there?
He's based on some people that I've known in my life that I've worked with and worked for. And I would like to be Peter Wake, but no, I'm not Peter Wake.
I'm going to jump to the question I had for the end of the script here. The book is dedicated to somebody. Who is that and why is that? Who was he?
Well, that's he's a very special guy. And
Captain Charles Klingenpeel?
Yeah. And Chuck, everybody called him Chuck. Chuck was one of my mentors, and I learned – he was a lawman. He was a soldier. He was a philosopher, and I first met Chuck, 43 years ago. He's passed on now, but I learned a lot from him, and I constantly remember him. And he taught me something, and it's in the book. It's actually in the dedication page. He said that this was the philosopher part of Chuck.
Mm-hmm.
He stopped and looked at the sunset for about 15 seconds. And then he ended, and then he went on about his way. And I asked him later, I said, what was all that about? And he looks at me and he said, you know, kid, the man that can look at every day's sunrise with anticipation of a great day ahead and every day's sunset with satisfaction of a great day done has truly lived every day to the max. And for the last 43 years, I watch every sunrise and every sunset every day.
You wake up before the sun every day?
Oh, yeah.
I'm proud of you.
Yeah, got to.
Is there a little bit of him in Peter Wake?
A little bit, yep.
Yeah. If you're just joining the show, I'm talking with Pine Island-based maritime novelist Robert Maycomber. The 14th book in his honor series, this one called Honoring the Enemy, was released last week. If you'd like to ask him a question or add your thoughts to our discussion, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. So your books are so steeped in history, and you go to the places and you research them so deeply that they provide lots of stepping off points for people who want to go further. Is that all by design, or is that just sort of an outcome of your process in a way?
No, that's by design. I want my readers I tell this story. I illuminate the stories of significant events in world history that changed our country and by extension the world. Because the world as we see it now, which is a little depressing, but as we see it now, the foundation for all of that was laid at the turn of the century, all the way up until World War I. So when I write about these things, I want my readers to go, aha, so that's why we do this, this, and this, and that's why this country is this way and that thing happened that way. And I'm one of the few novelists that does endnotes. Arranged by chapter at the end of the book. And I also do a research bibliography that I make available at the end of the book because I want my readers to be – maybe have their curiosity ignited by my book and then to read further and to go to the places. And I get emails from my readers all the time and they're all over the world. They're on the Mekong River or they're in the Atlas Mountains of Africa or they're in the Catacombs of the Dead in Lima, Peru. And I get an email and they got one of my books in their hand and they –
I'm here.
I'm here. It's just like you wrote in the book.
That's got to be pretty satisfying as a
novelist. I love that.
That's like the perfect
circle. Of course.
Right
I love
there.
That because they get it.
Yeah.
And so it's fun. And you know, I just had a 3-day reader rendezvous last month in Key West. And as part of that, I give a little walking tour and I show people the places in Key West that I write about in the 1800s, 1880s, 1890s. And they love that connection. And they love going all over the world to the places that are in a book because it connects them to not just something in a book but our own history.
Right, right. So, and in some ways framing, like you said, who we are today and what the world is today.
Exactly. Yeah. So I just tell the story by my fictional character who's inserted into that place in the world, and he has a viewpoint frequently from the shadows because that's where he lives. That's
right.
Where he works,
right,
in the shadows.
How much time do you spend reading history? Seems like you probably spend a lot of time reading history.
I'm reading about 5-6 books at once. Yeah.
Do you have a place where you like to read out there on Pine Island? Do you?
Well, I read in my office.
Yeah.
I read before I go to bed. Yeah.
What are you reading now?
Russian history.
Russian history.
That's a hint.
Okay. Well, you mentioned before when we were chatting before we went live that you will have multiple books that you're working on that are in different stages of development.
Yeah.
Can you kind of just – you don't have to give us any future titles or things away, but can you just kind of explain how that whole process works, how you keep it organized and that sort of thing?
Yeah. I've had to become very, very organized because – I do about 90 events around the world a year, and I'm a lecturer. So between doing research journeys and book tours and then lecture tours, if you're not organized and if you're not constantly working on these projects, you can get behind in a heartbeat.
No, absolutely.
And I have commitments that I have to satisfy. So to do a book, my projects – have different phases, and one of them is the academic research phase, which takes a couple of years. And then the next phase is the eyeball recon phase, which is where you actually go to those places in the world that you're writing about, and you immerse yourself in the culture. And you always, always find out things you never found out in the book research.
Right, right.
And you also are able to – you know, the books – will give you the facts of history. The eyeball recon gives you the flavor of history. What does it smell like on the Mekong River?
Right.
It smells differently at 3 in the afternoon from about 8 o'clock at night. Completely different. What's the food taste like in Cartagena, Colombia? What are the sounds at sunset in Marrakesh in Africa when the Muezzinin call the faithful to prayer? All those things aren't in the book.
Right.
You can research books all day long. You're not going to know that stuff until you go there. Then after that is the actual writing, which usually starts during the eyeball recon. And then after that, you work with the publisher. A lot of people don't realize that most writers have to get their book to their editor at least a year before the book comes out. And that year is filled with not only edits, usually there are 2 to 3 rounds of edits culminating in the final copy edit. But then there are the graphics people that have to put together not just the cover but the formatting on the inside. And the graphics on the inside.
It's not just accidental the way it looks.
No.
It is all done by people
who are
experts. Yeah.
There are the marketing people that get involved. And they get involved in all kinds of ways that are somewhat interesting. For instance, titles.
Well, that was my next question is do you get to pick those titles?
Or yeah.
They help you with them?
But they help me on subtitles.
Okay.
And some of the things that go into the descriptors on the book and the covers and things like that. And so there's a lot of people involved. And from the people that helped me on my research to the people that helped me get it into printed form to the actual distribution into the bookstores, there's a lot of people involved in putting a book together. If you look at my acknowledgments, I always try to thank everybody, no matter who they were. In my research, I've been going to Cuba now for 10 years. I've been there probably 25 times or more. And one of my first research in eastern Cuba, I was in a 1952 Chevy sedan going up and down 3,000-foot mountains and in through jungle trails. And I thanked that driver because he's also the mechanic and the owner, because if we had been stranded someplace, oh, man.
Yeah.
Eastern Cuba, oh, wow.
The Wild East.
That thing performed every day, though, every night.
I don't want to go too far into the weeds with the editorial process, but how does that work? Do you write out longhand? How do you get it to the editor? So you're writing on it. You're sending him a computer or him or her.
Yeah.
And then are they sending back like a notated draft so you can see what they're suggesting? Like, just talk about that a little bit. As somebody, you know, we do a lot of shared editing around here.
Yeah.
And what is the current way that works?
Well, modern commercial writers, we use, you email everything in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm writing and revising my stuff every day, usually in the mornings. And then finally, when everything's done and you've got, in this case, for this book, 116,000 words, then you send it in to the editor. And it goes initially to one of the in this publisher that I'm using now, the United States Naval Institute Press, acquisitions editor, and then they go on to a project editor. And they do a really broad contextual edit.
Right. Giving you sort of notes.
An overview.
Right.
And then they send it to a line editor. And the line editor just really delves into it. And they check on continuity and they check on veracity and they check on all kinds of other stuff. Because my books, unlike modern novels that might not contain a whole lot of technical stuff or things like that need to get checked, my books do. And they check all that and make sure everything's okay. And so that takes a while. And it goes through basically three editors.
Hmm. Are these people who you've worked with before or you're now at a new
– New publisher.
New publisher, so new editors?
New editors, yeah.
What was that all like? Or how did you wind up with the Naval Institute Press? I think that's what it's called, right?
Yeah. They came to me and they wanted to do my next book.
Hmm.
And it was an honor because they are the premier publisher in the world for maritime.
For what you do, right.
Yeah, for maritime subjects. And they only do one novel a year.
Oh, really?
They do about 100 books a year.
Okay.
But they only do one novel a year and they really wanted me to – be that novel.
Are they now your publisher for the rest of the series?
We're going to be doing a book-by-book contract.
Okay.
I don't do multi-book contracts.
Gotcha.
I like to be in control.
How many publishers had you been with before?
Or like, only one.
So was that from the very beginning, so from the very first book?
Right. Yeah. And we had a great team there. And they understood that, when I got approached by the other one, that I should, seize it. They understood that. And then they were bought out by another conglomerate. And so many of the people that I work with there are no longer there at the old publisher. So the book business is dynamic in many ways.
Yeah. Well, especially these days. I mean, lots changed.
Yeah.
You have so many, like we said, leaping off points in your books. Have you ever considered like a digital version that would have hyperlinks to where people could just, like here I am.
Yeah.
Oh, I can jump over there now and get a little backstory and then jump back in. It seems like yours would be maybe wired for that.
Yeah. We do that in the endnotes.
Right.
But, in the print version, you can't just, click on the
– Right, exactly.
But in
maybe like a Kindle version.
In the Kindle version, yeah. So the Kindle – it's in Kindle Nook, Scribd, and all these other things. So I'm old-fashioned. I like a print book. It's funny that you say that because, I guess it was about 7 or 8 years ago. A senior editor, the other publisher, said – listen, we want to do on the ebook version, we're thinking about including audio interviews with you where they click on it and then there will be direct links to various places and they were going to get all razzmatazz on the techie stuff. And I said –
You said simmer down.
And I said, well, that's your – that's their decision. It's certainly not my decision. And I said, but how much time do I have to spend on all these interviews and things? And they said, oh, it won't take long. We just want to do, a dozen or so like that. And I thought, well, now wait a minute. I don't mind if you use the endnotes that I put in. and the links that I have already in the EndNotes, but I just didn't have time to do all these other things. And other publishers have done that kind of thing, and maybe I will in the future, but I haven't yet.
Yeah, let somebody do that for you. I am talking with award-winning novelist Robert Macomber during this part of today's show. His newest novel, Honoring the Enemy, which explores a series of battles in Cuba in 1898 that were pivotal to America's rise to global power. If you'd like to add your voice to our discussion, give us a call now, 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So when did you turn your sights to writing novels? I know that this hasn't been – you haven't been a novelist your entire life. So at what point did you make that pivot?
Well,
did it seem like a daunting pivot? Like, yeah. I'm going to be a novelist,
I'd gone from writing periodicals to novels, and then I was also still writing periodical work for some newspaper things, but mainly magazines. And
was it maritime-y naval stuff, or was it historical, or was it just writing for words to get paid?
All of the above.
Okay.
And I had enough people that came to me, and I was doing lectures too. Mm-hmm. So I had enough people come to me and say, hey, listen, why don't you do a series of novels like Horatio Hornblower?
Mm-hmm.
And with the famous maritime novels that were done by C.S. Forster. And when you have enough people tell you that, you think, well, maybe I should.
Mm-hmm.
So originally we were going to do my internal plan was to do about five or so, maybe seven, probably five. And then we won several literary awards. That was nice. And I had the talk with the editor that every writer wants to have, where the editor said, why are we only doing five?
Mm-hmm.
Let's do more.
Mm-hmm.
So Then some more awards happened, and my geographic spread of my readership really started moving in all directions. And then I won the national award for my genre. And after that, they said, well – and every time we would win an award and things would get well, the editor – even better, the editor would say, now why are we limiting – are thinking on this. So, when you have those kind of conversations and you're the writer,
yeah,
then you try to keep your cool.
Oh, yeah.
And not
usually
like, jump
writers
up and
are
down.
Trying to convince everyone else to do
yeah,
more.
Exactly.
It's not usually the other way around.
So, it was a really good feeling. And I work hard on what I do.
It says on your website that this series is intended to have 17 books. Is that correct? Is that still the number that you're aiming at, or is that now in flux based on what we've just
flux.
Said?
You know, it's in flux. It could be more than that. So who knows?
How far?
I've gone back and forth between 17 and 22. It depends.
Okay.
There are a lot of factors involved. You know, are the readers happy? Are the publishers happy? Am I happy?
Right.
So
– and, you know, do you have to worry about where the story's going? I mean, you'll just
they're already mapped out.
They are already mapped out.
You know, real history.
You are that far out and ahead of things.
Oh, yeah. Real history is a bonanza of fascinating personalities.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't make this stuff up.
Right, right.
These personalities involved, the events, the locales.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is just amazing what you discover when you start reading. Reading books can be dangerous, you know. So
you know, this is an interesting sort of aside, but you know, we do the podcast Three Song Stories, which you were on at one point in the past.
I love
looked
that.
Looked that up, people.
Great idea.
Did an episode recently with a guy who was in town. He's a singer, songwriter, country genre named Grant Malloy Smith. He's played, you know, on – he's national.
Mm-hmm.
His latest album is a series of songs that are based on the Dust Bowl, and he he's done movie soundtracks. Stay with me here. He's mm-hmm. done movie soundtracks. So he would have the movie to come up with the music. And then he thought, mm-hmm. what if I pick a piece of history and make that sort of the movie that I make the music to? And he said, "That I'm just going to keep doing that for the rest of my life now," because it's kind of what you just described. It's yeah. like pick a piece of history, take the good stuff out of it, work some narrative around it, mm-hmm. and there you got it. Does that kind of resonate with what you're doing?
And watch the faces of the readers, in my case, or the listeners, in his case, and watch as they get it. You know, it really means a lot to you. Hmm. So, yeah.
It's kind of like what we do with the podcast. We get to use yep. the way music works as our engine, yeah. you know, and it's exactly. almost not fair. You've been a consultant for the Department of Defense, and mm-hmm. I want to read the quote here because I love what it says. "Specializing in strategic vision and planning by utilizing historical analogies of what works."
Mm-hmm. And what didn't.
And, yeah. and did you have a military background, or is that just you're such a historian of military history that you can look at things in a way that is beneficial to what they want to hear or see?
I've had a diverse background.
Okay.
And been all over, and I've worked with the military a lot. I've worked in all over the world with the military. I was just at Fort Rucker about 6 months ago. With the senior warrant officers of the Army and working with them. Hmm. That's a very sharp group.
Yeah.
Very.
Well, I imagine.
Very sharp. And I'm – it's
– And you're just in their Rolodex? Just sometimes they call up old Robert?
Well, you never know. So I'm actually trying to wean myself away from all that because I did that – I've done that now for 15 years. And I'm trying to just now concentrate on my lectures and my books and that kind of thing.
Do you travel for fun, or is it, if you're traveling, are you aligning it with something? Well, I mean, I know you're having fun when you're doing your research, but do you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, are you ever not taking notes in your head as something that might turn out to be important for a book you're working on?
No, my travel is usually work related. So I'm either researching, lecturing, or writing, or you know, doing something like that.
Or hanging out with your fans.
Or yeah, or having reader rendezvous in really cool places like Havana.
Yeah.
In Key West, and yeah.
What do you do?
I'm very fortunate. I have the best readers, the most enthusiastic readers of any author I know, and they sometimes get jealous. And when I go to a writer's conference and there's usually an author's room, which is kind of like a green room, mm-hmm. At TV mm-hmm. or NPR. And the writers get together and everybody starts talking about what they're doing. And I start telling them about my latest reader rendezvous and they all go, "Bob, now come on. We all know you love your readers." And they just don't want to hear about my readers anymore. So,
right, right.
But I love my readers, yeah. I have fun with them.
How did you come up with the name Peter Wake?
You know, I was going to use the name Peter Coffin. And it turns out that was a real name for a naval officer in the uh-huh. Civil War on this coast. So I didn't want to use that. So I was trying – I love that name though. I mean, what an evocative name.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was out at sea. Coming – sailing back to the west coast of Florida at sunset, and I just happened to have a rum drink in my hand. And I was looking astern at the sunset and just kind of mellowing out and thinking, what character name can I use and what is behind a vessel?
Right.
The Wake.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I looked at that and it just snapped in my mind and I said, you know, that word – it's easy to remember. It's one syllable and it has several different connotations, including a funereal one.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I decided to make him Peter Wake. On my second book or third book, I had a marketing person from New York call me. And this woman was gushing about the name Peter Wake.
Hmm.
And she said, "That's brilliant. Did you come up with that name? Or did some marketing people do that?"
Right.
Somebody... And I said, "No, I did that." And and she said on the phone, she said, "Well, it's got all the correct marketing sounds."
Hmm.
And I said, "Really?" And she said, "Yes. It has the soft sound, Peter is the sensitive sound. Uh-huh. And then wake has the hard consonant, and it's a long vowel, and it's a simple one syllable, and it's brilliant. And that's the masculine. It's sensitive and it's masculine and it's easy to remember. It's absolutely brilliant. And she said, "You came up with that?" Like I was some sort of Neanderthal or something.
Right.
And she said, "How did you come up with that?" And I said, "Well, there I was on my boat having a rum drink."
Well, I was just going to say too, I don't want to read too much into who you might be as a person, but if the marketing team had come to you and said, "We want to use this name for all these reasons," would you have been like, "Sure," or would you have been like, "No, it's not organic"?
No,
you know what I mean?
I like the name, so
yeah. Well, yeah, but if you had to come up with it yourself, like if you were stuck on somebody else,
I didn't get paid a marketing fee to come up with it though. And if the New York people had come up with it, they would have gotten a marketing fee for it.
Okay. Well, we only have a few minutes left, but I want to ask you a few questions. You said on your website that some of your novels have gotten the attention of filmmakers. Have any of mm-hmm. Have you wound up on the screen yet? Is that possibly in the works? I could totally see like a Netflix, you know, because now we have content creators that are stretching stuff out over time mm-hmm. and series, and it seems mm-hmm. like yours would have so much potential for that. Is that something that's happening or working toward?
No, not now. We've had five different companies that have looked at my books. The last one was a British company that was looking the book before last. And it was actually looking good, and we had a meeting in Cuba to go look at locales, filming locales. And then it all went belly up because it turns out the producer had personal problems, and to make a long story short, he went off to refine himself or
gotcha.
Something.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, yeah, it was looking very good.
Good luck to him.
Yeah, yeah. He's somewhere in England right now, wandering the hills. I don't know.
Oh. Who would play Peter Wake if you had – if that worked
We've
out?
We've done surveys.
Like who in your head do you see or do you see?
Yeah, we've done surveys with the readers on who they would pick.
Okay. Well, then who's the reader's
choice?
Now,
the last time I did a survey, it was a number of years ago, and it was Matt Damon.
Okay.
Yeah.
I could see that.
And for Sean Rourke, who is the other guy who's in all the books, and he's Irish-American, it was Liam Neeson.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
What's your next travel plan?
Well, I'm on book tour now. So
right.
I'm,
is that going good? You just launched it last week, right?
Yeah. I have 21 events around Florida, then the events beyond Florida – take us all the way up to Washington and New York City. So we have a very interesting – this is unique. We have a six – there's a place in New York City called City Winery of New York.
Okay.
It's very famous in Manhattan. They're doing a six-course gourmet meal with foreign cuisines from my books.
Huh.
Paired with very special wines and very nice rums.
That sounds really cool.
And everybody that comes to the dinner will also get a copy of the new book.
Hmm.
And then I'm going to be doing a reading and this. So the owner of City Wineries is one of my readers.
Oh,
and
wow.
And he really wanted to do this.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Living the novelist life.
Yeah. Huh.
We're out of time, but you have something you held up there you want to mention?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention – I wanted to invite everybody – to come to the 15th annual Reader Rendezvous Party on Pine Island. And it's this Saturday. It starts at noon. It's at Woody's Waterside Pub. It goes for 5 hours until 5 o'clock. And I will have all my books there. And I will be signing books. So come out and get a book. And we also – they put on a great slow-roasted pig. Hmm. They have fresh seafood. They have tropical drinks. And there is a 7-piece Latin dance band playing all 5 hours.
Huh.
So we have readers that come from around the country. We have two sailing fleets coming there, one from St. Pete and one from this coast. It's great fun. People go there for all afternoon and just relax and have fun.
Awesome. Well, so, good luck with that.
I'll be dancing and signing books for 5 hours.
Well, we appreciate your time as always. We'll have to have you back when the next book comes around. And that's it. So that is all the time we have for this part of the show. I want to thank my guest, Robert Maycomber, is an award-winning novelist as well as a historian and lecturer. His latest book called Honoring the Enemy hit bookshelves and online booksellers last Friday. Robert, it's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you very much.
When we return, we're joined by a senior scientist and program manager at Moat Marine Laboratory to discuss the salt-tolerant vegetable sea purslane that she's growing in an aquaponic system using salt water that's also raising redfish. I'm Mike Canary. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.